Well, good morning. It's nice to have everybody here. I'm really excited about sharing Doris Fuller with the church. Doris and I became friends about 2 years ago. I went out to a National Institute of Mental Health meeting that they had of people who were involved with various programs throughout the D.C. metropolitan area. And the morning was challenging, so I wandered outside to an umbrella table to take a break at lunch. And Doris wandered out and asked if she could sit next to us, next to me, because I was by myself. And we started up a conversation, and that has started a friendship and a mentorship for me since that time. So I am just delighted to have Doris here to share her wealth of knowledge about mental health, particularly the chronic mental health illnesses. She works for the Treatment Advocacy Center in Arlington, Virginia, and she's the chief of research, and she also does their public affairs. She is a professional supreme and has just so much information about this important field. So I am just delighted that she took time to be with us this morning. Next week we're going to have a missionary, Nancy Collins, come and be with us. She's a missionary in Malawi, and Patrick Honeycutt is going to be here to be the master of ceremony because I will be in Michigan next week. But please do come back and hear about a missionary whom we support through our International Missions Committee and learn more about what she does for PCUSA. And with that, let us have a word of prayer. Dear God, as we continue this series this year, Towards Fuller Faith and Service, we open ourselves up to hear about a difficult field that affects all of us, our family members, our neighbors, our friends. We ask you to help us to be open to hear both the challenges and the good things that do come from people who choose to take their gifts and work in this challenging field. We ask all this in Jesus' name. Amen. Welcome, Doris.
Can you all hear me? Okay. Well, thank you all for being here. I'm delighted to see you this morning. What a great crowd. And we're going to have a great hour, I hope. And I especially want to applaud Amy. Later in the hour, I'm going to talk a little bit about some research on the church and mental illness. It's kind of sobering research, and Amy is a counterpoint to that by introducing mental health to this congregation and by the church, you know, taking this subject on. So I applaud the church, applaud Westminster Presbyterian, Amy, and all of you for being here. So about 10 years ago, I would not have imagined I could possibly be here this morning talking about mental illness, mental health policy in America, and where the church fits in. Today, or yesterday I did this actually, if I Googled Doris Fuller and mental illness in Google, if I put that into Google, I get 166,000 hits. Okay, I don't talk that much. A lot of these are duplicates. I do realize there are other Doris Fullers in the world talking about mental illness. But I do talk about it a lot. How did this happen? What happened in 10 years that changed my life so I became sort of a servant to the cause of mental health and mental illness? Well, as John Lennon famously said, life is what happens while you are busy making other plans. What happened in my life 9 years ago this Christmas is that my daughter Natalie had a psychotic break right before the final semester of her senior year of college. This is why I read, because I can I can stay focused better talking about my daughter if I'm reading my comments than trying to ad-lib them, so forgive me for that. After a very short period of chaos by U.S. standards, about 1 month compared to the average of six years in this country, she was diagnosed with bipolar disorder with psychosis, severe psychosis, and hospitalized. In the next 7 years, Natalie was hospitalized for at least 2 months on four different occasions, and for a few hours or a few days, more times than I can remember. She recovered and relapsed, and recovered and relapsed, and recovered and relapsed. This is a very common pattern in the disorders I'll be talking about today, especially for young people who don't want to believe they have a chronic disease that is going to require major lifestyle changes. Besides radically changing Natalie's life and every dream and plan I had involving her, Natalie's illness led us both into mental health service. First, I became her mental health advocate. My first service was to my daughter, of course. She once wrote in a blog, "When I first got sick, my family somehow managed to mobilize school officials, the school psychiatrist, health and welfare officials, the police, the courts, and for all I know, the National Guard to help me out. I want to be on record that I never once called the National Guard, but I did call psychiatrists, social workers, judges, prosecutors, public defenders, police dispatchers, and hospital ERs, among others, in my efforts to help her. Advocacy was, at least initially, more a matter of survival than making lemonade out of lemons. But eventually, it became a way that both of us reframed our life-altering circumstances into an opportunity to improve the circumstances of other people in Natalie's situation. So, Most of the efforts came through the work that I have done as a professional advocate with the Treatment Advocacy Center. And because that plays a prominent role in my study, in my comments, I'll take a brief segue to tell you a little bit about the organization and how it came into our picture. So it's a national nonprofit. Its mission is eliminating barriers to the treatment of severe mental illness. I discovered the organization during one of my desperate searches for help. Another parent whose life had been changed by serious mental illness and who happened to be a Washington Post reporter had written a book called Crazy. And in the book, he talked at length about this organization. And when I read this chapter, I thought, wow, this sounds great. I went to their website. They were very helpful. And then within a few days, they were advertising a position that I was perfectly suited for. So, obviously, that was meant to be, and so I ended up coming to work for the Treatment Advocacy Center. Like many people, probably about half of people with bipolar, Natalie did not recognize she was sick when she was having symptoms. She wasn't sick, the rest of us were. Her line used to be, "I'm not crazy, you're crazy." This lack of awareness is a big barrier to treatment of people that have severe psychiatric disorders, and the Treatment Advocacy Center specifically works to change public policies that limit access to treatment for people in this category. Natalie was in treatment and recovering, I found the work they were doing so compelling that I moved all the way across the country. We were living in North Idaho. Does anybody in the room know somebody from Idaho? You know, I got here to Washington and people went, "Wow, you're the first person I ever met from Idaho." It's like, really? It's a state, you know? It's part of the country. But anyway, I moved cross country to join them. And in June, I completed my 7th year here. I've been in a succession of positions, including communications director, which was the one I felt perfectly suited for, executive director, which I got promoted into, and most recently chief of research, which is a role I created for myself as executive director and recruited myself to serve it. It was brilliant. My roles at TAC opened up opportunities for Natalie to be a mental health advocate, too. When she was well, she gave media interviews, appeared in videos, did public appearances, blogged, and otherwise spoke out about mental illness treatment as someone who had benefited from it. The organization's Treatment Advocacy Center's founder, psychiatrist E. Fuller Torrey, if anybody's read about schizophrenia, you may have come across his name. He used to say Natalie could be the most effective advocate with mental illness in the nation because her symptoms were so grave when she was ill, but she was so clear and candid about talking about them when she was well. She could write, she could speak, and she had a great sense of humor. Witness the National Guard comment. Dr. Torrey said I had two full-time jobs, saving Natalie from serious mental illness and saving the rest of the country from serious mental illness. That's probably an overstatement, but I'll take it. The average life expectancy for someone with bipolar disorder or schizophrenia in the United States is 10 to 25 years less than it is for everyone else. Suicide is a major factor in this mortality gap. The latest research I've seen, which is a paper that came out last month, reports based on a study of 40,000 medical records in the United Kingdom, found that people with bipolar in the United Kingdom were 12.6 times more likely to kill themselves than the general population. In the U.S., the statistics are a little worse. It's more like 15 times. In the end, I did not save Natalie. When she was well, she was very, very well. She graduated from college. She had an active social life. She created wonderful art, and she was employed. When she was sick, she was dangerous to herself. On March 14, 2015, just about two and a half years ago exactly, about 6 months after I sent her a text proposing dinner the next night, you know, when I was planning something else, Natalie killed herself by jumping in front of a MARC train in Baltimore. In an article I wrote for the Washington Post, which some of you may have seen at the time, it actually went worldwide, which is a testimony to how powerful the suicide message is. I said my daughter died of terminal mental illness, and that was the case. Now, early in Natalie's illness, I had a physician friend in my little town in Idaho, and she said to me Natalie and I were always very frank about her diagnosis. We felt that you do not demystify and destigmatize if you are not frank. You know, most of us in this room lived in the days when nobody said breast cancer until Betty Ford said breast cancer, and mental illness has not yet reached that point, but it won't until more people say, I have mental illness, or my loved one has mental illness. So I had this doctor come to me, a friend, and she said, you know, don't worry about Natalie's diagnosis. You have no idea how many people in this town are living with bipolar disorder. And I said, really? Do I know them? And she said, sure. But they're all doing very fine. They're in treatment. They're stable. They're successful. They're married. They have kids. They have lives. They have jobs. Thank you very much. So that was an enormous encouragement to me and to Natalie. And we both worked ferociously to make her one of those people. The fact that Natalie died is not a reflection of our efforts, nor of the countless people who also worked for and with Natalie over the years, but it's a testimony to the severity of the disease and the sad truth, and who in this room hasn't lost someone to cancer or any number of other diseases, that medicine does not save every patient. And Natalie was just one of the patients that was not saved. But I remain motivated to serve by my conviction that more people need the opportunities that Natalie had from her treatment to be one of those who succeeds. So what I'm going to do with my hour here, or what's left of my hour here, is I'm going to give you a very quick overview to mental illness. A lot of you, serious mental illness, a lot of you may know some of this, but I'll go through this pretty quickly. And if I bring up something and you say, wow, I would like to have heard more about that, I'm going to leave 15 minutes for questions and answers at the end, or 10. We'll see how we do. So I'll go through this pretty quickly. Then we have a little interactive exercise that I don't know if we'll involve everyone because it's such a big room, but we're going to do a little exercise in being inside someone who has a serious mental illness. And then I want to talk to you a little bit about the church and mental illness, not because I'm an expert, but because there are experts who have been studying this. Okay, about mental illness. Thank you for the water. All right. Mental illness and serious mental illness are very slippery terms. You will hear from the National Alliance on Mental Illness, NAMI, that about 1 in 4 Americans has a mental illness, and the Treatment Advocacy Center says 1 in 25 has a serious mental illness. So where is all that coming from? That's a question I'd rather leave for the end rather than get into it, but I can explain it. I want to talk today about the 1 in 25 that the Treatment Advocacy Center works with, in part because these are the ones that have the most impact that the public sees. These are the ones that make the headlines. These are the ones that end up in our tax bills and in other places, hospitals, ERs, jails, and prisons. So the illnesses I'm talking about today, let's see what my second slide is. I'm going to go forward and then come back. So the illnesses I'm going to focus on here, so my comments will be focused on these and to some degree major depression, but these are illnesses that are severe enough to chronically impair an individual's ability to carry out daily living activities, like family relations, friendships, school, employment, economic self-support. When the government develops data about this population, they're usually talking about, and by data I mean like jail and prison data and so forth, they're homelessness. They're talking about schizophrenia, bipolar, and major depression. And you'll sometimes hear, anybody ever heard of schizoaffective disorder? Schizoaffective is sort of a mix between bipolar and schizophrenia. It's not actually doesn't have a diagnostic code, but it's recognized by clinicians. Okay, so what we have in America, these are 2016 numbers. We've got about 8.2 million people with these diseases. Bipolar affects about, on average, 2.2% of the population, the adult population. That's about 5.5 million people. Schizophrenia, 1.1% of the population, about half the prevalence, 2.7 million people. Despite this, these are economically some of the most disabling. I think there are 2 and 3 in the most disabling medical conditions in America in terms of what they cost in employment and public services. So bipolar disorder is basically, it's a brain disease, it's a psychiatric disorder. It causes unusual shifts in mood, energy activity, and the ability to carry on daily living. Schizophrenia is chronic, severe. It distorts the way people think, the way they act, the way they express emotions. If you know anyone with schizophrenia, you sometimes see that flat affect, you know, that they don't engage. How they perceive reality and how they relate to other people, which the flat affect involves. Now, these are all, you know, these are chronic brain diseases. They're not a choice. It's not just if they behave better, it would go away. None of them has a known cure at this point. I should have a great big yet. But all can be treated. Some can be, there's a range of severity and a range of treatment effectiveness, but all of these diseases can be treated, which is really important to remember because people don't have to live this way. Now, although they can all be treated, at any given time, so we've got 3.9 million of these people in this slide right now are not in treatment of any kind. They're not receiving medication. They're not seeing doctors. They're not getting any help at all with managing their illness. So what does that produce? And this is the part I'll kind of skim through so we can get on to some of the other things. But it's important to understand, you know, mental illness affects us all. Whether you know someone with it, it affects you if for no other reason than because you're a taxpayer. 10 to 20% of all police calls involve mental health or a mental health distress call. 20 to 50% of jail and prison populations are people with a diagnosable mental illness. 30% of people living in solitary confinement have psychiatric symptoms. Imagine that. You are in a psychiatric crisis and you are in a cell 23 hours a day, isolated from other people. 25 to 50, and the reason these ranges are so big, you guys, is that our research on mental illness is awful. It's getting better. The treatment advocacy is working on this. Amy's husband, Representative Upton, has worked on it by co-authoring the 21st Century Cures Act. We are addressing some of the data problems, but right now we don't know enough. So a lot of the numbers are quite fuzzy. But we know that a minimum of 25% and probably closer to 33 to 40% of all civilians who are killed in a law enforcement encounter have a serious mental illness, are in have psychiatric symptoms at the time. So we've had all this furor in recent years about police shootings, fatal police shootings. They're, you know, and for good reason. But what often is overlooked, and I did a paper called Overlooked in the Undercounted, Overlooked in the Undercounted, is the role of serious mental illness. So in almost somewhere in 1 in 4, 1 in 2, fatal civilian deaths, we're not counting just shootings because they usually aren't fatal, what few people know, are people with serious mental illness. And 20% of all law enforcement officers who die in the line of duty die in an encounter with someone with serious mental illness. 30% of our chronically homeless males, 50% of homeless veterans, 66% of homeless women have a diagnosable mental illness. 90% of all suicides. I know you guys had Tom Insel here about a year ago, or 2 years ago now, and that's a figure Tom often used. We have overcrowding in emergency rooms nationwide, so this is a problem. And if so what are the numbers? Well, this is kind of what untreated mental illness looks like by the number. You know, we've got about 170,000 homeless adults with untreated serious mental illness. We've got, I think the latest number on jails and prisons is about 363,000 inmates with serious mental illness. Why isn't it better? Well, in 44 states and D.C., we have more people with serious mental illness in jail than in the largest psychiatric facility in that state. Law enforcement has really become our default. We have the suicide risk. We have the fatal law enforcement encounters. We have 95% of jails report they have inmates with serious mental illness. And then we have things that, you know, affect outside of the criminal justice system. Anybody been to an ER lately? You know, how long do you wait for treatment? ERs around the country have overcrowding problems. It's something they're working hard on. What is the biggest source of overcrowding in ERs? In many places, it's their psychiatric patients because the people are untreated. There are few resources for them to get treatment, and so they end up in the ER, and oops, there are not enough psychiatric beds, so they sit in the ER waiting for a bed. That means they're taking up space, they're deteriorating, and they're not getting the treatment they need. So 90% of ER physicians in this country say they board patients in their ER because they don't have a bed for them. 84% say that patients wait for more than 12 hours for a bed. There are cases where people have waited weeks, and there was a recent settlement down in South Carolina against a hospital that had one patient who waited 18 months in an ER for a psychiatric bed. This is not a blueprint for success, and it's not humane. And sadly, the sickest patients wait the longest. The worse your symptoms, the more likely you are to be sitting in an ER, in the chaos of an ER, because the less likely there is to be a bed to treat you, because you're more profoundly ill and it takes more specialized services. And so the sicker you are, the longer you wait. So, why? Why does this happen? Why do these people end up in jail and prison and not in treatment? Let's see here. Why does mental illness make some people more likely to be homeless? Why do they have more contact with the police? Why are there so many negative consequences associated with serious mental illness? We are now going to do a little exercise to illustrate why. And so, just it's like, I hate to disrupt you when we're all so settled here. Actually, before we do the exercise, Amy, I think I'll talk a little bit about the Church of Mental Illness so we don't lose that at the end. Then we'll do the exercise because the exercise really leads into the discussion and the Q&A. So let me just tell you very briefly a little bit about what research says, not me, but what research says about the Church and mental illness, since you are all congregants and obviously you care. Thankfully, blessedly, there are dedicated church leaders like Amy, like your pastor, who and progressive churches like Westminster, who are willing to, you know, bring this issue to the fore and do education, raise awareness and cultivate compassion. But there appears to be some room for improvement, and here are just a few of the pieces of research that have come out in the last few years. So a 2011 survey of 6,000 individuals in Protestant denominations found that mental illness was reported in 27% of the families. So that really gets closer to the NAMI figure, 1 in 4 families. Now, these are not all serious mental illness, but about 1 in 4 families in your church has themselves or lives with mental illness in one way or the other. As the person themselves or as the family member. A survey found help with the depression or the serious mental illness of a family member was listed number 2 in a survey of these 6,000 people as their number 2 priority. The rest of the church congregation, helping people with family members who have depression or severe mental illness, was ranked number 48. So there is a gap. And this you guys may have seen some of the headlines, churches ignoring mental illness nearly invisible in church congregations, and church congregations blind to mental illness. Interestingly, individuals in psychiatric or psychological distress are more likely to come to a religious leader in their church than to any other professional, more likely to come to their pastor than to a psychologist. And yet, another study, 2008, of self-identified Christians, Catholic as well as Protestant, 18 and over, found that 1/3 of those who approached their church leadership for assistance because they or a family member had been diagnosed, not that they thought maybe there was something going on, they had been diagnosed with mental illness, 1/3 were told that they did not have a mental illness. There was no mental illness there. So that was the feedback they got from their church leader. And by the way, given the demographics of this room, women were significantly more likely than men to be told there was no mental illness. Within this 30%, this 1/3 church, these members, and this tended to be more in conservative churches, were told the cause of their problem was solely spiritual and that it was a result of their symptoms were a result of sin, lack of faith, or demonic possession. That's 1/3. But then, you know, a different study by a Christian research organization found that 48% of people who identified themselves as evangelicals believe that people with serious mental disorders can overcome illness with Bible study and prayer alone, along with 35% of all Americans. So America believes the church is very powerful, that prayer works, and prayer does work, but mental illness is a disease, and we wouldn't try to pray our cancer away. So we can't really pray our mental illness away either. I'll have to show you the slide because I'll give away the punchline if I go forward now, so I'm not going to do that. But you know, I want to say, and I'll show you a slide later, you know, SMI, serious mental illness, is hiding in plain sight all around us. You know, it's in this room, it's in this congregation, it's in your neighborhood, it's in your family. You know, one of the things I tell people all the time is a lot of us don't know if mental illness is in our family because it wasn't talked about 30 years ago. We may have had Uncle Fred that's maybe a bad name, Uncle Joe, who had a drinking problem who had some kind of a behavioral problem. And everybody just thought he was this or that or the other, and today he would be diagnosed with depression, or he would be diagnosed with bipolar disorder, or maybe even schizophrenia. That's always been a little more obvious. But it's hiding in plain sight. And we can't all be professional advocates like I am, but we can all be personal voices. We can all be compassionate. We can all educate ourselves so that we understand the problem, and when we have an opportunity, we can advocate for good, better policies. And Amy, she's brought some crisis guidelines that we produced at the Treatment Advocacy Center. So, and those will be on the side when we end. So, you know, I remember my first NAMI meeting after Natalie got sick. I said, I never expected to be in a room like this. And everybody in the room said, neither did we. You know, mental illness chooses us. Nobody chooses mental illness. So the crisis guidelines, if there's anybody in your world or might be, they're just some simple guidelines about dealing with crisis. So what we're going to do now, what we're going to try to do is we have an exercise that we're going to do. We've got how many people? We probably don't want to take half the room outside. Takes up too much time. Okay, so we're going to divide roughly into three groups. We're going to have patients who stay in the room. We're going to have interior environments who come out of the room with me for a brief instruction on the exercise. And then we'll have observers. And I think what I'm sort of tempted to do is to have the front three tables be observers, and that means you'll get to turn your chairs and face everyone else for a few minutes when we come back in. That might be good. Have the middle three tables be patient for a day, and the back, I'm looking, the back two tables and the people against the wall be interior environment. And then if somehow this has resulted in more patients than interior environment, more interior environment than patients, we'll conscript some of the observers. If anybody doesn't want to be in a patient or interior, you can scramble around when I stand up to take the interiors outside and take an observer seat. I think we've got enough people to go around. It's going to be very simple. The observers are going to have a very simple task. It only requires that you are able to read. And the patients have another simple task. It only requires that you have a piece of paper and a pencil in front of you. So with that, if I could get the back row or those of you who want to participate as interiors and the two tables there to follow me, we're going to go out right around that corner and close the door for a few secret moments. And what we're going to do when we come back is we are going to simulate what it's like to have a serious mental illness. And I'm going to turn my mic off so I don't broadcast the secret instructions to everybody in the room. So this is not a test, patience. You're not going to be graded. It's okay. Don't stress. But there are some rules. Do not ask questions. So don't ask your neighbor what they're doing. Do not look at your neighbor's paper. You've heard this one for many years. It hasn't changed. Do not interrupt me. You know, don't say, oh, what was that you just said? Mm. And don't make any comments until we are all finished. And then when we finish, we'll all be able to talk about this. So everybody is in position. Okay, so people, the patients, have your paper and your pencil ready. I'm going to start reading the directions shortly and just follow the direction I give you. Might be better to start at the top of your page because you're going to work down. Okay, all right, let's begin. Okay, patients, draw a square. Draw a square. Can you all hear me? Everybody have their square? Draw a second square. Place the right side of the square midway down the bottom of the first square. So go to the bottom of the first square and make your second square midway, start midway across. Okay, now, let's start a third square. The third square, it's even hard for me. You want to make your third square at an angle. So place the top of your third square midpoint on the lower right corner of your second square. Now draw a fourth square. Place the top midpoint of your square on the lowest point of the third square. And the last one, draw a fifth square. Place the top point on the bottom left-hand corner of the fourth square. All right, stop. And interiors, thank you. Everybody can resume their seat. Does anybody want to show me your page? Oh, that's pretty good. Oh, you didn't have, oh, that's interesting, but you had no, that is real. Let me have someone who had someone. Oh, this is a good one. Can I have your, just, I don't know how well you can see these, but just hold up your own to your people at your table and see what they all, now see, this is interesting because Judy here didn't have someone murmuring in her ear. Just keep this one in mind. And Gail did. And now I'll show you exactly what it should look like. This is why I couldn't fast forward before. Now, whose looks exactly like this? Judy's got pretty close. Does anybody's? Did we have any winners here? Okay. Of course not. Okay. Patience, how did that make you feel? Did you feel brilliant? You feel competent? Do you feel comfortable and relaxed? Okay. Did anyone just tune out and say, I'm not doing this? I don't blame you. I did this once, and I was one of the patients, and it was like, I don't do things I don't do well. I'm not doing this. interior environment. What did it feel like? You know, what did your message seem negative to you? Could you hear the wall of sound that began filling the area? Okay, now let's stop and think about this a minute. You are hearing these voices. You are out wandering in Old Town Alexandria at midnight, and a police officer comes up to you and says, "Stop right where you are." What do you hear? Do you know he's real? You're hearing lots of voices. They all sound real. So you're in a courtroom. The judge asks if you understand the charges against you. If you hear that, what you understand is someone is telling you, hurry, run away. This person can't be trusted. If you're living on the streets, imagine we've all seen people on the streets talking to themselves. They're talking back. What if you're a student? You're in a classroom. You're trying to learn. You're trying to finish college. And this is going on in the background. Natalie went through that. You're on the job. One of the saddest things to me, Natalie had gotten a job at Macy's for the Christmas season about 3 months before she was before she killed herself. And she quit in a couple of weeks. And the problem was she couldn't tell when the customers were talking to her and when her voices were talking to her. In a social setting, trying to have a relationship. Okay, so we agreed this is pretty overwhelming. And this is what contributes to where we are today. So now that I've shifted everything around, what I'm going to do, do you have any comments about what you just did? Yeah.
But it's so hard to, like, you know, now what do they say? Now,
yes.
You know, so that's what I was feeling. I was like, I want to do this, and it was really hard for me to focus.
Yes. And that's a very common experience, you know. They're trying the very best they can. It's just that the very best they can is interfered with by all these exterior, interior stimulation. And you know what? This is psychosis. Most people don't have psychosis. But, you know, there are many other... Depression. You know, anybody who's been depressed knows that script that runs, I'm no good. I can't do this. I won't succeed. Yes?
Wasn't everybody daydreaming at home? And how do we know when
it's real? One way is to ask, you know what I used to say to Natalie? Natalie used to say, Mom, you get manic too because I have a lot of energy. And I said, yeah, but I never do anything inappropriate. So if you're daydreaming and you think you can fly and you go up to the fourth story of a building, which is something Natalie did, then it's probably a good sign that this is not just daydreaming. And another thing, that there are people who function... psychotic symptoms are not treatable. There is treatment resistance. So about 25% of people, no matter how adherent they are to their meds, they will still have symptoms. And some people learn to live with those. They learn to do like a check-in. You turn to your wife and say, do you hear the symphony playing Beethoven's 14th? Fourth. And if they're not, then you go, well, that must be one of my inner friends. So there are ways you can... You know, it's based on how you behave when you hear these things or think these things and whether other people can verify them. Does that help? So you're probably just fine. Yes?
One other thing is that this is just a two-minute exercise.
Yes.
You've dealt with this day in, day out, year after year. Your confidence goes so far down. And people who know you and love you all around you are looking at you strange.
Yes.
Because what you see is...
I know.
You're like, well, I can't trust myself at all.
I know. And I know, you know, Natalie, one of my oldest friends is a neuropsychologist, and after Natalie died, she said, you know, Doris, And Natalie was psychotic when she died. And when Natalie was psychotic, her voices always told her to hurt herself. She believed that if she either hurt herself or killed herself, there were all sorts of good things that were going to happen to everyone else. The world was going to be cured of cancer. There would be no more war. She had all these very grandiose ideas of what would happen if she hurt herself. And then she would recover, and she would remember that, and she would like, this is so crazy. And my friend said, you know, Doris, even though Natalie was psychotic when she died, she was not out of touch with reality. She realized this was going to be her reality for the rest of her life. She was treatment resistant. Her voices were horrible. They prompted her to do horrible things. And she didn't want to live that way. Amy. Yes. Exactly. That's a great question. So there's this long word called anosognosia, which has Greek roots that I won't go into. A means without. Sognosia has to do with knowledge. And roughly about 40% of people with bipolar, 50% of people with schizophrenia are believed to have this co-occurring brain condition, and there's a lot of research coming out, brain imaging, that it affects a certain part of the brain where judgments are made, and the person is not able to recognize they are sick. Now, this is not unique. Anybody know anyone with Alzheimer's? This does not occur only in mental illness. It occurs in, there are actually stroke patients who, it occurs rarely in blindness. You know, people who have other medical conditions and the part of their brain that recognizes their own illness doesn't recognize they're sick. So you get that in about half of people with schizophrenia and bipolar. Probably less true in major depression because depression is more reality-based. Bipolar and schizophrenia go farther from, they're more delusional. Although you do get psychosis in about 10 to 20% of major depression cases. So it's a co-occurring brain condition. You can't talk people out of it. And that's part of why, you know, the Treatment Advocacy Center, one of the areas we work on is reforming laws that control access to involuntary treatment. I mean, basically, we believe that at some point someone is so sick, so dangerous to themselves, and so in need of care and can't choose care, that we shouldn't just wait until something bad happens to them or the people around them. So we have worked over the last few years to reform treatment laws. We've been in a pendulum in this country for years to reform them so there's more access sooner, better access sooner for people exactly like the ones that Amy's talking about, the ones that don't know they're sick. And Natalie was like that when she was symptomatic. So what would happen is she'd get in the hospital, she'd get on meds, she'd go, oh, did I really do that? You know, Patty Duke, had bipolar disorder, and she wrote a wonderful book, and one of the things she said in it was, you don't need therapy when you're actively sick, because she had bipolar, so she was manic, she was having a great time. You need it afterward to deal with all of the chaos and just devastation you left behind you. So Natalie would, you know, once she was in treatment, then she would recognize she had an illness, but while someone is seriously actively ill, it's very hard. You can't convince them they're sick. And so how do you get them into treatment? To wrap up and then take final questions, you know, the last night I saw Natalie alive, and this is, of course, very bittersweet, she said, you know, Mom, there's one good thing that's come from me being sick, and it's everything you've done for mental health, which was very generous. You know, and I had other plans for my life. I had other plans for my daughter's life. God knows she had other plans for herself. But life happened, and then death happened. It happens too often, happens too soon, happens to too many people. And that's why I serve, to make it happen to less people. So I want to thank you and congratulate all of you for coming here and being here today to learn more about this important topic that really ultimately touches us all. I feel like I was lucky because I could be an advocate. I think there are big and little ways that all of us can be better advocates for mental health and those who suffer without it. So, with that, we have 5 minutes, 4 minutes. What are your other questions about anything? Oh, wait, I did have, so this is what I couldn't fast forward to. Mental, like this little butterfly, mental illness is hiding in plain sight. And this is my darling daughter, Natalie, when she was 3, one of my favorite pictures. She was hiding in plain sight. And I do want to say that I found one of your next mental health speaker, Amy. This guy, Matthew Sanford, is at Baylor University. He has a he's the founder and director of something called the Mental Health Grace Alliance. He's written a book about Grace for the Afflicted, a clinical and biblical perspective on mental illness. He's at Baylor University. A lot of the studies I cited are studies that he has done. And he just says, ignorance is simply not an excuse for a community of believers that has been called to bear one another's burdens. Significant strides have been made. More work is needed. Education and collaboration are the best tools. Thank you for coming to be educated, for collaborating on our exercise.
Church is going to read together in the next couple of months and then just have a one-time discussion. It's called Darkness is My Only Companion, A Christian Response to Mental Illness. I've read it. It's a great book. I recommend it even if you don't want to participate in the small mental health group, but I hope that you might. So I will put it, you know, in our Chronicle and other places. I hope you will come read it with us. And I know Doris is going to remain for questions. And would be happy to meet with some of you. I have a gift for Doris that's on the other side of the room. Just
thank you
so much for being here and helping us to name, you know, our part in this difficult challenge in the world. And I am so sorry about Natalie.
I know. We all are.
We all are, and we are so grateful for your gifts that you do bring.
Thank you.
Your advocacy.
Thank you, Amy. Thank you all for your attention. Oh.
I have a question.
Yes.
I think one of the big problems is that treatment for mental illness is very expensive and it's often not covered on health care.
Speak up, Judy.
Do you have any hope that we will get mental illness covered as we have physical illness covered?
She asked, is there any hope for psychiatric care, mental illness being covered like other medical conditions are? It's a very good point. We did get a parity law passed by Congress 4 or 5 years ago. What we know in the mental health field is that there is more parity now. So if you have an insurance plan that provides certain benefits for other medical conditions, they have to provide equivalent, say, hospitalization benefits for mental health problems. We also know the law is being widely ignored, and there are no sanctions for ignoring it. So that hasn't helped. The ACA has helped. You know, it has made, you know, mental health care affordable by getting more people on Medicaid, and Medicaid does cover the drugs. A significant number of people in America who are on Medicaid, I want to say half, maybe more, are there because they have disabling mental health conditions and they can't work. But if you are on your own and you don't have one of those insurances, yes, some of the treatments are really expensive. More are becoming generic. That's a mixed blessing. It makes it cheaper to buy medications. The drug companies have basically stopped researching psychotropic medications. There's a little going on, but basically so many things are going generic, costs so much, the problem is so intractable, so many things are going generic that they would just as soon invest their money elsewhere. So this is one of the kind of looming crises in mental illness, is that we don't have a pipeline of drugs today. Yes. And then back.
Are there any statistics as far as, since this is organic brain disorder, in worldwide, are those statistics, those percentages about the same across the world?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. I mean, they're the same in India as they are in the UK. That 1.1 for schizophrenia and 2.2 for bipolar. Bipolar is a lot fuzzier. And you'll see also 3% for bipolar. This is just the most severe cases. But by and large, all the world sees the same numbers. Now, the treatment, the U.S. Has poorer treatment options than most of the Western world. And then some of the undeveloped countries have totally different approaches. You know, they're more of it takes a village. So you'll find in India, people can be maintained stably on lower doses of medications, but they're living in a village where everybody is participating and supporting them. They're not isolated. And so that person gets other kind. I mean, it's not all about pills. They get other kinds of support, and they do well with much lower doses of medication. But basically, the prevalence numbers are, and they've been around for a long, long time. I mean, schizophrenia has been recognized for probably thousands of years. There was a hand back here. Sick again.
And is there any work being done to try to sort of take the responsibility off of the patient to take the medicine, you know, like a patch or sort of ways to make sure that the person takes the medicine even if?
Yes, even if. That is another great question, and it's actually, and I hate to seem like the bad news bearer, there really is good news in this area beyond the 21st Century Cures Act, for which we're terribly grateful. But in this area, some of the things that are happening are apps, you know, apps, a variety of things that people can use that will remind them, will let their, let their provider know that the prescription was supposed to be filled yesterday and it didn't get filled. There's also some neat stuff in voice recognition. You know, when Natalie was getting manic, she'd call me up, and I could tell the instant she said hello that she was taking off like a rocket. And they're finding that voice recognition can pick up the pitch of someone who, with incipient psychosis, incipient mania, depression. And so there's some apps on that. There's some apps, I think, that even record, like when Natalie was manic, she'd be texting like crazy. She'd go through her whole data plan in 2 days. And so there's some apps that either tie the patient in with the clinician or the family or just gives them their own feedback of, you know, when someone is fairly far down the course of an illness and they want to stay well, then they can look at the app and go, oh my gosh, I texted 250 times today and 20 times yesterday. I probably need to call my provider and tell him I think I'm getting manic. So there are some things like that happening. They're pretty exciting. They're still in development, but there's stuff going on. Yes. It all went away.
And I wondered where, I mean, it didn't look like a very pleasant place to live, but I wondered where the people who really needed inpatient treatment all went. I didn't think they all just got better.
That's a very, that's a whole other lesson, but that's a very sad story. I mean, we had a trend, it was a worldwide trend, deinstitutionalization. There was a belief that people would do better in small settings in their community, and there were some there were some political wins. There were some economic incentives. The federal government passed a law that if you were a psychiatric patient in a facility, a psychiatric facility with more than 16 beds, Medicaid couldn't pay for your care. This really motivated a lot of people, states and private people, to get out of the care business. So basically, those state hospitals that were everywhere in when I was growing up, certainly, 95% of those beds are gone today. So the population of the United States has doubled since the peak of psychiatric hospitals bed numbers, and we have less than 5% of the beds we had then, and half of those beds are for people who've committed crimes and are being referred to the hospital through the criminal justice system. So really, we have 2.5% of the beds for people like Natalie, And she was lucky. She was able to get a bed when she needed it. And not all of the people who were in the hospital then need to be in the hospital today. We used to hospitalize geriatric patients. We used to put people with dementia. We used to put people with epilepsy in state hospitals because there were no epilepsy drugs. Families didn't know what to do. There were a lot of people there that don't need to be there today. But what happened was those community centers that were built, by and large, were not set up to treat the sickest patients. They were set up to treat people who were well enough to walk in and say, hey, I'm depressed, or, I can't stop washing my hands, or whatever the symptom might be. And so over the years, basically, the sickest people were left without treatment. And so if you add up all the numbers of the homeless with mental illness and the homeless in and the people with mental illness in jails and prisons, it's about the same number of hospitals we used to have, hospital beds. It's called transinstitutionalization. We've just transferred them from big hospital facilities to big jail and prison facilities and the streets. I know you guys have other things to do. Why don't you come up here, and I'll answer any other questions. Thank you.